with a little technical help, Chuck, I've got it. How are you doing?
Okay.
Well, good. And the class didn't hear this, but you said you forgot all about this.
Well, because I'm working on this new paper right there with new stuff, so therefore I forgot all about it. I did.
And you were going to the post office?
Yeah, I was going to go to the post office.
Well, B had had to take your place. I'm sorry. I got through telling him that this has never failed. And then I said famous last words.
Yeah, all right. Go ahead.
Go ahead. What is your new paper about?
It's still about Taylor at Bethlehem, but I'm looking at a lot of other things that happened before. In other words, his connection to Bethlehem is not just for Judas to Davenport. It's also because he owned stock in Simmons' rolling machine, and also Morton, who was the president of Bethlehem, Sam Taylor, sold the stock too in 1890. And I got an 1890 printout from the state of Massachusetts of all the stockholders, all the handwritten data. And there's Morton in there. Taylor sold the stock. That meant that Morton knew what Taylor was doing long before he ever went to Bethlehem. And Morton also sent Morton a special copy of his peace rate paper. He sent special ones out to people before he ever gave it to friends. And he sent it to Morton to press Morton what he was doing, both at Simmons and maybe for the future. And therefore, when they needed to solve these problems at Bethlehem, they Davenport and Morton, naturally, they turned to Taylor. So he set their thing up long before. So in case something went wrong with Simmons, he had a port of call to go to.
Well, why did Morton fire Taylor, Chuck?
Well, Morton didn't fire Taylor.
Well, that was my understanding.
No. Well, Morton was going to sell this plant anyway. He didn't really give a hoot about the company. He got tired of it after a while. It's a complicated thing as to who fired what and why. There was, this big, they fired lots of people. There was this torchlight parade through Bethlehem going to the houses of executives they wanted to get rid of.
The world hasn't changed much then, has it?
No, the world hasn't changed much.
Well, let me introduce you to my class. We've had an opportunity to read your pigtail article.
God, it's so long ago. I knew so little then.
Sign of a well
educated. We all knew so little then.
The more you know, the more you know you don't know.
That's right.
We've read the last chapter of your book with Ron.
Ron wrote that.
Well, that was my guess.
And there, I would not have written that chapter.
Hey,
Rand thinks it's the best chapter of the book.
Well, I like it too. Now, why wouldn't you have written that chapter?
I didn't want to have anything to do with it.
For what reason?
I just didn't want to have anything to do with it. First place, I thought this whole book should have been torn apart and rewritten again after I got it done, and I could see how it should have been. But you can't do that with these publishers sometimes,
Well, there's some question that chapter seems to be a little bit more considerate in its judgment of Taylor than your earlier paper.
Yes, and I wouldn't have written it.
But tell me why.
What's a crook? Always a crook. You can't change crookedness.
And who's the crook?
Old Fred. Remember your program, Frederick W. Taylor, Wizard or Weasel, 1975.
They've heard that.
Hit it right on the nose when you made that title up. I wouldn't have made up that title, but I never would have thought of it. But you had a good idea there, Wizard or Weasel.
But you remember, Harold Smitty, bless his soul, took great exception to that.
Oh, that's tough. But, once a weasel, always a weasel.
Well, you've been at this plenty of times, and so what we're going to do, I've got a good group, they're seven, and they've got some questions for you, and I'm going to ask each of them to step up, identify themselves, and we'll take it from there. How does that sound?
Okay.
Sounds great. Who'd like to be first? Go ahead, and step up to the speakerphone, and that way the recorder can hear you. It's September the 8th, 1992, and give them the full name and what your question is.
Hi, I'm Janet Runge, and I'd like to know how you got started on Taylor in the first place. It seems to be kind of a personal thing.
My wife went to an old bookstore and bought a copy of Taylor's Shop Management for 15 cents and brought it home to me. And I just started to look at it. But the more I looked at it, the more it looked strange to me. There was something strange about that book. As it turned out, of course, it was strange. Taylor didn't have much to do with it. Thompson did most of the work. And I don't know, I just had the feeling there was something more to this story than met the eye. It all sounded too glib and too easy to happen that way. And then I was teaching a class. The other way I got involved in this, I was teaching a class in 1962, a beginning course in management, and I got the idea in my little head that it'd be awfully nice if we could have, then there weren't any camcorders, but if we could have tape recordings of some of the people who originally helped develop the field of management. And then I started to look back at who were the oldest. I mean, Taylor was dead, so I figured, and I had Marshall and Crook had died, and I had him on tape, and I had Carl Bartson on tape, but I decided to look back on maybe, and I figured it out, that Henry Knoll, who moved to Pigard for Taylor, was born in 1871 in February, and therefore he still could be alive in 1961 or 62. He could be alive. He'd be old, but he could still be alive. So I decided to look at the oldest person first. And that's how I really got involved in it, because when I began to look at Knoll, and I found Philip, I found the Wally family, and I found Philip Wally, and I found all these records in Wally's.
Is that W-O-L-L-E? Is that how you pronounce that?
What?
Is that Wall or Wally? Is that the
Wally.
Same? Wally. Okay, we weren't sure.
W-O-L-L-E, Wally. And his father, Hartley C. Wally, fell out of an airplane and died. He fell 300 feet. And you usually don't get up. And that meant he didn't go back to his farm. And on his farm, he had saved all the records that he had when he was at Bethlehem, and they were in the barn. So they were still there. The place is all torn down now. It's a housing project. But anyway, and once I found those, and I knew there was more to this story, and I got more interested because it showed that Taylor's stories were just absolutely so much fabrication that they weren't even real. And that's how I really got involved. I really got involved because my wife bought that book, and I started to look at it, and it didn't sound right to me. I can't tell you exactly why it didn't sound right. And later on, I found why it didn't sound right, because Thompson wrote part, and Taylor wrote part, and so forth and so on. So it just didn't all flow together properly. So that's how I got going. And the more I got going, it's like everything else, you see. People always are mad at me sometimes for finding things. But you can't find them unless they're there. You couldn't find that Taylor was a little hanky-panky, a little crooked and not quite on the straight shooter if he wasn't. If you find the letters and all the stuff that show that he is this type of person, if he wasn't that type of person, you couldn't find him. That's just why people say, well, why do you find these terrible things? Well, you can't find these terrible things unless they happen.
Give us some example of some of these terrible things.
I mean, that's to answer your question in a long, roundabout way. But that's how it was all fortuitous. It was not planned in any manner. It's just that one thing upon another started. And the more I looked at original things, the more I looked at things that other people had looked at, the more I looked at people that Taylor never even talked about, the more I found there were a lot of people who did the work that Taylor's taking the credit. You know, it's like Elton Mayo, who apparently never did anything in life but drink and go to Harvard about an hour a day, but Mayo never did anything. Other people did all the work. He just took the credit. So we have a lot of these, you know. It's like Bush. Bush probably can't write he's probably worse than Quayle at spelling, but he has a lot of speech writing, and he reads well off these cards. I don't sometimes make mistakes. But I don't think Bush is so smart either, you know. Good thing that nothing happened with the country when he was running the CIA. We'd probably been, you know, really up the river here. But that's to get out of something else. So I don't know if that answers your question.
Next.
Hi, Dr. Reggie. My name is Randy Satoum. I have some questions for you, but in the course of the conversation, another one popped in my mind. What do you think, or what do you think about the people who have come to Taylor's defense and have their opinions that are as much for Taylor as yours are against him?
Well, I usually find that those people haven't looked at any original documents. I think that's the real problem here. They're looking, you know, sometimes guys come to Taylor's defense by citing something. There was a when Art had this seminar in 1975 or this thing. I can't remember the guy's name. It was a paper that did a fellow gave a paper on Taylor. As Taylor is a human relationist or something like that, or organizational behavior. Is there something of that nature? Who knows? And he cited all kinds of things from Taylor's stuff to prove this. Well, in the first place, he cited things that Taylor never wrote. They were all written by Morrison, Welland, Cook, and a guy by the name of Alfred Barter. And then he has to twist and turn and maneuver them to make it fit into this thing. You know, it doesn't come out clear. But I think the main problem I have is that the people who are making the criticisms who wrote something that said that I looked up the South Bethlehem Globe and the other Bethlehem newspaper to see if Taylor's stuff was ever in there, because he said the newspapers had attacked him.
Talking about Ed Locke's paper.
Yeah, Locke. And then Locke said, well, what if I looked at some other papers? So then I looked at the Allertown papers, it's not there. And I looked at the Easton papers, and it wasn't there. Now, I don't know what papers he wants to look at. Now, if he wants to prove that I'm wrong, that it wasn't a paper, then Locke should find a newspaper that has it. I mean, but I don't see Locke ever going out to look this stuff up. Locke is always has his angle, but he might attack you. But I don't see him going out and finding the things to show that I'm wrong. You know, he just said, well, why did they look here or look there? Why doesn't he look there? Nah, they don't do that. They just say, he should have looked here and should have looked there. And you look here, there, and don't find it. They say, well, it's someplace else. All right, then where is it? And if he's that eager to prove that you're wrong, then he should go out and go hunting and searching for a newspaper that has it, if he can find it. But they don't do that. They take the easy route. I find there's a lot of easy route people in this world that do it the easiest way possible. They attack you, but then they just try to play out how wrong you might be. But I find either they don't have any original documentation, or their criticisms are that you did this or that, but they can't find any way to prove that you were wrong in the first place. And that's my main criticism against those people.
Next question.
I like Locke. He's a nice person. I have anything against him. I think we get along nice as people. It's just that he has a certain point of view, and he gave a talk at Stevens once, and I went there, and he defended Taylor to the hilt. But he said a lot of things that weren't true, and I pointed out their letters and documents to show that had never happened. So I don't think he'd like that, but I said it anyway. So that's my criticism here of these people. I wish someone would come along, and I would love someone to find a newspaper article where they attack Taylor for his work at Bethlehem and this and that and that. I would just love to find such an article. I'll never find it in my lifetime, but if someone would find it, I would be very happy that they did, really.
Next question.
Dr. Reg, I was wondering about the discrepancy between the pigtail article and the last chapter of the book, but I think you've explained that.
Let me just say something here. You see, this book has a this book actually it falls into a category which historians would call a dubious document. No, I'm just telling you, a dubious document. It's a regular historic term. A dubious document is a document where like two or more people have written it, but there's no way of telling who wrote what. That's a dubious document. Now, the only way to correct a dubious document, or to really find out, is to get down to the original handwritten material to prove who wrote what. That's about the closest you can get. Now, unfortunately, we do have a world now, which I'm absolutely against, in a way, of people with word processors and things like that. Word processors and things like that make it so it's almost impossible. If the guy doesn't, I write everything by hand. I don't put anything on a word process, and I let someone else do that. And I keep all the handwritten stuff. So somebody could go through all that and prove whether I did it or not, and they could find that certain parts of that book are not in my handwriting, and then I don't know if Ron keeps all his stuff that way. If they could find it was his handwriting, they could ascertain who wrote what. But we are moving to a world of technology where this might not be possible anymore, and then correcting the dubious documents now I had originally planned to put there, but the publishers didn't want that in there, you know, indicating which parts or which chapters were written by, you know, contributed more by one than another, but that didn't sort of, you know, fly very well. They don't like that sort of stuff. So there it becomes a dubious. I'm just using that term to tell you it's not a frivolous term. It's a term that you should keep in mind at all times. Whenever there's a book with one or more author, even with one author, you ought to worry about dubious documents. There's a lot of ghostwriters around. But with two authors, it becomes harder, you know. And if there's more than two authors, then you really got a problem here because you don't know which author did what, usually, unless you get to the original manuscripts. That's the only way.
How would you like us, if you had the chance to change, how would you like us to remember Taylor? And maybe why did you choose your co-author if he disagreed with you?
Oh, well, Rod and I are very good friends, and we've worked together for years. I don't think Rod really beats what he says in that way. I really do. I mean, it's like everything else. You have to have something ending up the other way. I don't know. No, Rod and I are very good friends, and he and Art, I would say that Art and Ron and myself may be the only people who are really maybe interested in looking at things very carefully. Then you get to Dan Rent, who's interested in looking at things very carefully, but not too carefully. And then you get down the line to people who write textbooks and stuff, and most of them don't know which hand is, you know, they're the people that have R on their right hand and R on their left hand printed in, so they know which hand is which. They can't do anything right in most cases, even these books. So I wouldn't want to comment how I would end it up. I wouldn't have ended up that way, I'm just saying. But at that point, you get to the point in time, I mean, I think Art knows this, when you're in a book problem, you get to the point that these editors are just hounding you, and you've got a new editor every week giving you the business, and you say, let me get rid of this thing. It's too much. I can't take it anymore. And I think that's what happens. And that's why a lot of things happen that maybe wouldn't have happened. And I find that the people who want to stick to their guns absolutely all the way end up not having anything in print.
Next question.
I'm Dr. Reck. My name is George Danforth. When it was first mentioned...
Ooh, here, Danforth.
Yeah?
You don't come from New York State, do you?
From what state, sir?
New York State.
New York State? Yeah. My family does.
Ithaca?
I don't know. My father was born in Poughkeepsie.
That's very interesting. I'm very interested in the Danforths.
We're not quite as aberrant as the Taylors.
Story, but I'm very interested in the Danforths. They did a lot of things. I'm interested in transportation, too. And the Danforths, Richard Danforth, did a lot of strange things in public transportation in New Jersey. That's all. And he died up in Ithaca. So go ahead. Sorry.
That's interesting. Okay, what was my question? Oh, yeah.
How do I know?
Well, you seem to know a lot about my family. When it was first mentioned that we'd read your Pigtail article, you made the remark that, well, how little you knew then.
Oh, yes, that's right.
And I was thinking, if you could change, what would you change about that article?
Well,
if you knew then what you know now.
I'm sort of changing the book, but I'm changing it more in this paper I'm preparing now for next year. The thing is that the whole, it's in the book too, but it's not as clear, I would think. The real reason for all